When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You can talk about film with a philosopher's zeal, or measure them all by box office appeal. But for once in your life,
be real!
Welcome, one and all, to a movie reviewing, reappraising, and genre hopping podcast on the Playlist Podcast Network. This program you're listening to currently is called Be Real. I'm Chance Solon Pfeiffer.
And I'm Noah Ballard.
Noah, happy March to you.
Happy March to you too.
Yeah, how are things for you? You're half vaccinated.
You know, people felt bad when I had underlying medical issues, but really I was just playing the long game to cut the line here in the apocalypse. How are you?
I'm fine, man. Just had the virtual Portland International Film Festival out here. Watched a bunch of movies, none of which we have the time to discuss on the podcast, because you and I've got a date with the man who would be Kane. And even though I said it, credit is to you for that, to that name.
Thanks. There was always also a documentary made some years ago with that title too. It's kind of an easy layup in retrospect.
But what else would you call your podcast about the films of young Michael Caine? We're celebrating both his birthday this month and the 50th anniversary of the film Get Carter. We thought we would dive into the front third of the esteemed acting career of this, you know, star of the 20th century, who people in our generation are more familiar, I think, with emeritus stage Caine than these films.
I know I certainly was more familiar with Alfred and The Right. Broken Voice more than I was familiar with these sexual maniacs that he played in the 60s and 70s.
So we are going to talk about Alfie, Get Carter, Italian Job, and The Man Who Would Be King. I'm going to do a little mini... We were going to do Sleuth, but, you know, you can't rely on streaming services for everything, fine folks. Every once in a while, there's like a totally normal movie where you're like, that'll be there, right? And then it's not anywhere. What the hell's that about? So I found a DVD at Movie Madness. Thank you, Movie Madness. We'll talk about just a little tiny bit about that. But those are going to be our main four.
Right. And the original genre, I wanted to say, was that these are not only early Michael Caine movies that were successful, but they were early Michael Caine movies that were so successful that within the preceding 50 years, they were remade.
Yeah.
You know, notably, well, Jude Law notably filling in for the Michael Caine character in two of them.
Right.
Which, weird. That's like a weird thing in retrospect to be like, wait, are you trying to tell me that in 1966, Michael Caine was like young, virile Jude Law?
In terms of the sexuality depicted, it seems like that's what's going on. I do not think he exudes the same, you know, licentious energy.
I don't know. Like, I find Jude Law to be...
He's one of the most beautiful people.
Yeah, at least 60% more, like, just dripping with sex appeal than Michael Caine.
Right, right.
Maybe it's just I have, like, old man goggles on and I, like, can't see him as a younger man.
Well, to your point... Even as a young man, he himself enjoyed wearing old man goggles. Like, he wore those giant black glasses that you could weld in. So, yeah, to your point, there were these remakes, but then we thought we would get in Man Who Would Be King, because that's a classic.
It's just a classic.
Also, obviously his movie stardom begins with 1964's Zulu. For the sake of the survival of our podcast, we thought only one nakedly colonialist film can be in here, and we went with Man Who Would Be King instead of Zulu. But
right,
that's his breakout.
I think it's got enough for the rest of them.
I would agree. Zulu seems interesting. I watched some clips. It's a well-regarded movie. It essentially seems like it's sort of like the British Alamo. Like, it's just kind of like one long battle where the movie like pretends that these are not rabid colonists in a land that doesn't belong right to them, and it's more about the nobility of combat against long odds.
Right.
Before we dive in, I want to tell you two things. One, we're happy as always to be a part of the Playlist Podcast Network, where you can find other shows like the Playlist Podcast, happening sometimes twice a week now, and The Fourth Wall with regularity. You can find these on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, wherever you happen to get your shows. We always appreciate a kind rating or comment if you would like to support the podcast network. Also, if you like what you're hearing here, the Be Real Patreon is up and rolling. For $3 a month, you can get two bonus episodes each month with Noah and I. Noah, we have a watch party coming up on Sunday, March 21st at 10 a.m. Eastern. What are we watching?
We're watching the 1999 classic, The Mummy.
Ah, yes. Everyone is
do
welcome.
Do not read from the book. No, death is only the beginning.
Do not read from the book, but please do join us at our free watch party. All are welcome. So,
born Maurice Joseph Micklewhite Jr., Sir Michael Caine.
Oh my God. I love it.
What is there to say?
When we do these biographical episodes, Noah is always like champing at the bit to give me like the hospital wing the person was born in.
Yeah, just their full like pre-death obituary here.
What's interesting, I think, is that especially in Nolan movies and for Americans and post the Cider House Rules Oscar in the late 90s, Michael Caine is often used to signal a kind of refinement in movies. But this is not the case, especially in English movies in the 60s and 70s. Case in point, one of the things I found really interesting in doing some research is that his acting idol growing up, it's not Laurence Olivier or James Mason or John Gielgud. It's Humphrey Bogart. And I think that you can feel that. He is not like a raw actor per se, but what he's doing is often like very simple and very direct. And one of the things I found with all these movies is that I think he's really trusting the script in a lot of cases to carry the layers of the character. It doesn't mean he's doing a bad job or an uninteresting job. But I found that a lot of these movies, there's like a text that's working somewhere on the level or sometimes away from what you're actually watching. And I think that Caine is kind of just sometimes being a tough guy, being a charmer, and letting the movie work. He's not pushing very hard ever.
No. And I would say, too, that his physical performances, at least in this, like, 10-year period, are pretty, like, subdued and also sort of, like, all poking around this same sort of persona that, of course, he would reinvent, like, in the 80s and 90s and then re-reinvent to the present.
Mm-hmm.
But it was interesting to me, like, what you're talking about is how like the script is shining through. And I would take it a step further that he's almost typecast to play these kinds of tough guy roles, like the guy with the unflappable sort of set of like this code that he's living by. But ultimately from the like the he's a little left of center, as they say.
Right. And I think the fact that he is left of center, the fact that he's not Humphrey Bogart, portends one of the things about his career where he actually finds his lane, which is that he is the best in team-ups. He's the best when he actually like lets Laurence Olivier or Sean Connery, you know, or Steve Martin be at the center of the frame, and then he is a great second banana, who actually, in some cases, the other part of his persona we should talk about is that he really, like, often exudes intelligence. I mean, I think there's a commonality in these four movies. It's that his character is always smart enough to get into trouble.
Get your knee off the steering wheel.
I can't. I'm stuck.
Here, look out. I'll do it.
Oh!
Well, you all settled in? Right, we can begin. My name is...
Alfie.
Bubbles with impudent humor and ripe modern wit, says the New York Times.
I was having a beautiful little life. There was this manageress of a dry cleaners. And I was getting a suit cleaned in the bargain.
Everybody's running after Alfie.
Do you love me?
What can I say when you ask? You shouldn't ask, you know. I'll tell you when I feel like it.
Would you like me to give you something to make you sleep?
Now, there's a good idea.
All right, then. Come with me.
Alfie, 1966. An unrepentant ladies' man gradually begins to understand the consequences of his lifestyle. I have to say, IMDb user generated synopsis here. That is a super misleading way to describe this movie.
You think so?
I think on the surface of it, like, yes, that is an accurate way to say how this movie goes down. But I would argue that gradually is doing like a lot of work,
right?
In that I don't know that he really ever learns the consequences of his lifestyle.
No, I think he perhaps feels deeper pain and then is confused.
Right. I mean, he just like becomes an old loser,
right?
Not to spoil it.
Right.
So essentially you have the movie opens with Alfie and the Daphne's mom from Frasier, who's steaming up a small British vehicle in the late 1960s, like by a gasoline treatment facility. And the movie sort of brings us in with this, like, surveying the collection of wild dogs that have taken up residency at this place.
Yeah.
And then we kind of pan to this, you know, bumping and moving vehicle. And we're introduced pretty quickly to the aforementioned unrepentant ladies' man, who is fully clothed, mind you,
yeah.
And he's Michael Caine, and he pops out. And what really surprised me, I guess, from it being a movie from 1966, is from the jump, we break the fourth wall, and Michael Caine's like, let me tell you about my wild lifestyle here.
Yeah.
And then the movie kind of unfolds with the episodes from this kind of dirtbag's life, and he also narrates like a parallel story of what he feels is happening.
It's funny you call him a dirtbag, because this is a proto Fleabag.
Yes, for sure.
And yes, I do want to say that breaking the fourth wall to that extent at that time was a pretty revolutionary choice. I was trying to do some research. There were things in, like, Laurel and Hardy movies where Hardy would kind of, like, aw shucks, break the fourth wall, but I could not find... And I think you've got some things in horror movies where, like, the host will talk to the audience, but not the main character high-fidelity-ing for the entire film in the 60s.
And having such dissonance between, like, what's actually happening on screen and, like, the right. commentary you're getting.
Yeah.
Which I think, yes, it's totally smacks of Fleabag.
Yeah.
Pretty quickly, too, I think it has to be said up front, I would say in the first 45 seconds of this movie, if you do choose to watch it because of the podcast that we're doing right now, buckle up for it being like pretty uncomfortable in a contemporary context.
You talked about the difference between the narration and what you're watching. This is based on a book by Bill Naughton and a play from the early 60s. There is this text happening about who is, I think, essentially like an aging sex addict, basically. As we said, realizing and then not really realizing what's happening. And I think sometimes the movie is aware of that. But the execution, the part of this movie that seemingly in 1966 swept audiences off their feet, which is just Alfie, you know, barging his way like through all of these relationships and very quickly having a child and being kind of like smitten with that child, but then also like wanting nothing to do with it. And I don't like his sexual values, even though he talks about them constantly, they don't make any sense. What I'm saying is the comedy part of the movie where you're supposed to go, oh, Alfie, you dog, for the first 45 minutes before reality sets in. I don't go, oh, Alfie, you dog anymore. It's just like, oh God, is this guy going to get what's coming to him?
Right. Yeah. I mean, arguably he does. Sure. I mean, he like ends up dealing with some pretty serious illness, of which of course he like uses to his sexual advantage, including sleeping with the wife of the guy in the bed next to him at the hospital after she witnessed him just having sex with some nurse.
Right. But yeah, was there any part of like the sex comedy here that like worked for you or felt or like, you know, breezed its way and like that you found easy to watch?
No.
So I think you're just talking about a movie where half of it like doesn't remotely work in.
I just think we've had such a hard swing away from having characters like this be, you know, as you say, like incorrigible.
Right.
And I think the movie does make an effort to bring reality to him in a way that's ultimately like not celebratory of his behaviors, but at the same time, like, you know, he's such like a Bukowski character or something, you know, where it's, I mean, yes, there is something about his pathology here that's, you know, pathological, but I don't know I don't know what the appetite is for that to be a sympathetic character in terms of, if we're talking about watchability.
Right. Well, I think we could actually put a little more effort toward trying to place this. So what he is an insurgent of the sexual revolution in what is portrayed as like a still pretty conservative working class London. And so there is this kind of funny, like, he enjoys sexual conquest, but like nobody suspects him because he's just like popping around to doctor's offices and dry cleaners. And seemingly, we don't know this for sure, but like women are getting their kicks with Alfie and not their boring husbands or their boring boyfriends.
Well, he says that. That's like one of the first thing he says is that like, you don't want to make things too serious. You know, they've got serious at home and that's what my appeal is to these women.
Right. That's true.
I think he's right in a certain way, but I think like what's been so eye-opening about the change in sexual politics between like the incorrigible man and, you know, reappraising that is the idea that, sure, he's right, but you're also talking about a system that he's exploiting, where it's like women who need to tether themselves to a man in order to survive in this community being abused by this man who understands that their life is without a ton of passion.
Yeah, your options were like World War II vet with PTSD who like now delivers milk. Or this guy who's at least willing to like joke and talk, but the things he's saying are all like, if you're a bird, don't talk to me about being a bird. It's like, okay, Alfie,
right?
Please.
And he also refers to his lady friends as it.
Oh,
did you notice that?
Yeah.
Like that he doesn't even acknowledge that they're people. I don't know. There's something icky about this movie. And I think it's hard to like really evaluate it. You know, yes, I think on a technical level, it gave us, you know, John Cusack from High Fidelity and Fleabag. But in terms of like this being, I mean, it's a movie from the 1960s. Like, how could it possibly be in step with like how we understand male female relationships? And the fact that it does kind of like the iconography you're talking about of the bird and the dog, like one of those is a predator and the other one is a prey. Like that's the image.
It's frustrating, I think, to watch people try and fail to connect with Alfie over and over and over again. And he actually, in a lot of these movies, is playing characters that absolutely no one can connect with.
Right. Yeah, there is not a bridge, especially in this one, that Alfie will not burn. And that is kind of tough to watch. You know, and I think this character will go in kind of an interesting place going forward, you know, with the sort of rise of unlikable protagonists in the 2000s.
Right.
But yeah, it's definitely ahead of its time here, but definitely like in retrospect, a sort of jarring way.
Right. Should we tell people how we rate movies and then rate Alfie? On Be Real, we rate movies in two categories, good or bad for technical quality, and a good or bad for watchability. So what are the four possible ratings?
I don't care!
Good movies are both well-made and highly entertaining. The Fugitive, Parasite, Rear Window, or The Hunt for Red October.
Once more, we play our dangerous game.
Good-bad movies are often impressive technically, but also tough sits. Historical melodramas like The Mission, horror movies too scary or gross to rewatch, or self-serious musicals like Yentl.
Papa, can you hear me?
Conversely, bad good movies are highly flawed but still gratifying. Nonsensical hangouts like Hot Tub Time Machine or ludicrously fun action fare like Twister or Stargate.
Give my regards to King Tut, asshole.
Bad movies are neither well-made nor entertaining. Examples we've covered, unfortunately, include Garden State, 50 Shades of Grey, and Attack of the Clones.
I'm deeply sorry, Master.
Got all that? Time for a rating. This is probably my least favorite of the four. Just because
I think I disagree with you there.
Okay.
But... I think this one
it's a courtesy
the
good
most
bad?
Difficult watch.
A courtesy good bad or a
no
a bad bad?
No, I'm going in with clear eyes here. I say this one's a bad bad.
No, I'll join you. This movie did not.
Oh, you're coming over to bad bad?
One of the things is that he's a character unlike what's the high fidelity character's name? Rob
Gordon.
You're just talking about
Rob Gordon.
Someone who's so out of touch with his own emotions and psychology for the purposes of creating dramatic irony that like it just doesn't make that part of it doesn't make sense in a 2021 context either, to say nothing of the politics. Like people are just so self-aware today. It doesn't mean they're right about themselves, and especially doesn't mean it produces laudable behavior. But yeah, there's something about Alfie where at the end he's just like, I'm just going through my life and like, what's going to happen to Alfie? And then the song's like, what's up with you, Alfie? It's like, it's like, Alfie, are we sure he doesn't have a clue? And like that part, you can't really even invest in like his own vision of himself. Yeah, I'm with you. I think it's a bad, bad, unfortunately.
Come over to the dark side.
That's what's going on with Alfie.
Should we go to the Italian job?
Go. You're only supposed to blow the bloody doors off. We are about to do a job in Italy. It's a very difficult job, and the only way to get through it is we all work together as a team. And that means you do everything I say.
It was 1969. That this one is a comic caper movie about...
Come on, synopsis. You don't tell us it's a movie.
A comic caper movie about a plan to steal a gold shipment from the streets of Turin by creating a traffic jam. So in this one, our man Kane plays Charlie Croker. Captain to me, I'm sorry. Who's just getting out of prison... which must be a totally fabulous prison because it's run by Noel Coward,
right?
Which is in a role of a lifetime,
I guess.
But yeah, so he's coming out of this prison and, you know, looking to go. No, he never really makes an effort to go straight. It's very like Ocean's 11, where it's like he's getting out and then suddenly he's lying about, you know, not gambling and not going to Las Vegas.
Right.
And he's looking for his next score. And he hooks up with this Italian guy who, in the prologue, gets killed in this horrible car crash in the hills of Turin because this mafia guy like set up a trap for him.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something out of this movie, like, has so many interesting touch points of other movies of this era, because there's something very like Bond villain about the setup to the beginning and then all the mafia guys wearing the same sort of Kill Bill black suit with the skinny black tie. And they like come and go as if you like look away too fast, like 75 of them are gone. It's unbelievable. But yeah, so the Croker storyline though is this sort of, again, very Alfie-esque character getting out of prison, trying to facilitate the plan that the Italian guy who died in the opening was trying to do about shutting down the traffic system in this town square enough that it would cause a traffic jam when this gold shipment was going from the airport to this bank. And much like any movie of this space, we see like the various characters that Croker picks up, Croker's six, or whatever.
Oh, I think it's more like Croker's 21. It's a lot of people.
Well, there's like the immediate guys, and then there's like people who show up in the action sequence in the back half of this movie, and it's like, I guess you're on the team.
Right. Did anybody stand out to you among the collaborators and conspirators?
The only incredible visual wink to separate any of these supporting characters out was the weird moment when Benny Hill like gets out of that bus and he like tweaks that woman's tush.
Yeah.
And it like goes fast as they're like running away from each other really fast, because like, I mean, does he have like some sort of rider that like all Benny Hill performances like must be in fast motion, otherwise they exactly like, that's so weird to have like you cast just for a sequence where they speed up the sexual assault that you commit. This movie's also like creates this Michael Caine sex addict who alienates the woman close to him, who like picks him up, and they're like a criminal couple.
Yeah.
It's like Tess from Ocean's 11, if she like hadn't gotten so pissed that Danny was a con man, kind of thing.
You're talking
it's like
about
Tess in Ocean's 12.
Lorna, played by Maggie Bly, yes.
And, but then he immediately just like fucks her over.
Well, it's super weird though. She takes him to a hotel where she's like, Charlie, my love, you're out of prison. Obviously, the thing you want to do is have sex with me and 10 other women. And then,
right,
as like a gift.
And there they are in this hotel suite. Yeah.
And then like 10 minutes later, she goes to meet him in this like strange, like open concept mission that he lives in. That's like decorated like a dorm room with just like blankets and stuff as the only like dividing walls. And he's having sex, I think, with 3 women in that scene. And she's like, no. We only got to do this the one time when I arranged it. People's, yeah, the understandings around infidelity and exclusivity at these times are so curious to
me. But then she ends up getting arrested for all the things that she did to like set up his wonderful release party.
Right.
Which is sad.
Poor Lorna. Completely disappears from the movie.
Yeah. She's almost like a Harley Quinn to this like weird R-rated British Joker.
I have to say, it's a little bit of a bummer, but the first hour of this movie just like did not do much for me, to be totally honest.
It's a snooze. Yeah, for sure.
Bit of a snooze. There are a couple cool things, like there's the smash cut from the fake funeral for Auntie Nellie, where Noel Coward essentially just like threatens them all, where it's like, you'll be buried next to Auntie Nellie if you fuck this up. And then there's a smash cut to Michael Caine basically like waving a bunch of cars and vans onto this boat that's like rickety in the black ocean, like, we gotta go, come on. that's a good scene.
Yeah, there's some great photography, I would say, I mean, in all of this movie, but it really is like it takes its time kind of creating the aesthetic that it wants you to appreciate in the back half of this movie, which in its defense, I would say improves drastically.
The aesthetic pays off. Other than one scene where you're like, why are they crashing cars in that particular way? I don't think there's like a ton of planning payoff, though, where you're like, oh, why were they doing that? And then it comes to fruition. So that's kind of odd as well. The supporting cast did not, you know, there's no great getting the band together scene, which is kind of a bummer.
The movie has the challenge of, you know, basically having the first half be the character development and the second half being like the second unit with all the cars,
right?
And there's like not a lot of overlap. I mean, like there are shots of like, are the characters that we've gotten to know over the preceding 45 minutes, like driving around these cars. But for the most part, it's like very heavy action and not like, I mean, I would say really cool, like car driving in urban and then very rural setting photography.
Set to Quincy Jones.
Set to Quincy Jones, which is an incredible thing to do, which will inform the Fast and Furious. I mean, without this one, how would we have gotten Mark Wahlberg's Italian job?
The last 40 minutes, though?
Awesome.
Alternately fun and exciting, and then sometimes just, like, adorable. Like, watching those little Fiats drive, like, on top of modern art museums while, like, one cop is like, I don't know which corner of the roof to go to, and the Fiats are like, ha-ha, well, we're driving off the museum now.
Right. Yeah, no, I think it's really cool. And I think it's, you know, occasionally cutting away to Michael Caine. He's not even really driving that much.
Nope.
He's like kind of sitting in the back of that other truck. You know, and there's like the coolness of them like coordinating everything. And then like the cars like drive onto that bus. And
it's neat.
You know, it is neat. It's really neat. But like you said, you know, I wish the first half had more, dare I say, you were only supposed to blow the bloody doors off scenes.
Mad respect for the ending, though. I know this movie is over 50 years old. If for some reason you're like, I gotta go watch Italian Job right now, skip ahead 2 minutes because the ending, like the actual ending is real. I think the single best part of the movie.
I think it definitely, like, the irony how this movie ends really adds something to it, in its being like an action movie that isn't afraid to not have a happy ending.
Right.
Right. I guess the whole thing you're supposed to weigh at the end when he's like trying to get that gold is like, is he Peachy from The Man Who Would Be King, who like doesn't care if he's going to die with his buddy, like from getting killed by a huge group of people. Like they were there for the laugh.
Right.
And this one's similar, but the laugh is like, we're here for the money.
All right. What do we rate an Italian Job?
The Italian Job, I believe, is a good bad.
That's what I would say too.
And I think the technical prowess on display, like in the back half of this movie, more than justifies like the perhaps slow start. But I think good bad.
One day, a professional killer went home to visit his family and found his brother murdered.
Now, who killed him?
I don't know nothing.
Now listen, the only reason I came back to this crap house was to find out who did it. And I'm not leaving till I do.
Michael Caine is Carter, a man with unbridled hate.
Do you want to be dead, Albert?
For Christ's sake! You knew what I'd do, didn't you, Albert? Listen, Christ, I didn't kill him! I know you didn't!
When a professional killer hates, he turns animal. And there becomes but one law in the underworld jungle. Get Carter. Get Carter. Before Carter gets you.
Don't let us interrupt you.
1971, Get Carter. When his brother dies under mysterious circumstances in a car accident, London gangster Jack Carter travels to Newcastle to investigate.
This movie is very creepy.
It is a creepy movie. And it's definitely now that Michael Caine character that we've seen in the past two movies cranked up to like giving absolutely zero fucks.
Right.
And adding a violent component to it.
Indeed, indeed. I think, but I what I'm trying to say is also a compliment to Mike Hodges, who wrote and directed the film. I think that the atmosphere of Get Carter and the use of place is very creepy. I mean, it opens, Jack Carter is a hired gun for the London mob. It opens in this, you know, dimly lit room where I think there's slides showing through pornography, which is foreshadowing for what's about to come. And he like goes, you know, it's doing nothing for him. So Jack goes to the bar and pulls a scotch bottle out of like what turns out to be a music box, which adds some other kind of creepy ambiance to what's going on. And then just the way Newcastle is shot, I think there's a scene early on where they're getting drinks after Frank's funeral, and you see this alley, and it looks like it just runs downhill into a coal plant, and you get the feeling that this entire town is kind of like a storm drain where everything just flows right down the hill into the saddest, most exploitative kind of industry. Or at the end, the sand funicular that's just taking sand off the hill and dumping it into the ocean. It is a great use of an industrial setting.
No, I totally agree with you that the feel of this movie is like super unique in that sort of gritty, like post-industrial revolution hellscape kind of thing.
Or but also like this is another part of it, like a beachside town that's like, but we want to be a tourist town. And so you have like just the weirdness of like a couple like Coney Island carnival things, but mostly hellscape.
Yeah, there definitely like was an attempt years ago to like bring in people. But I think now the town, and like one of the sort of fun things about it is how insular it is.
Yeah.
And how like almost like a, well, and this sort of gets into like one of my first quibbles with this movie is that like this town, Newcastle, has its own language. And so the beginning part of the movie, Michael Caine like kind of has to like almost code switch back to like how he talked at home before he went to London and like hit it, you know, big time with being a higher breed of gangster or whatever. Mm-hmm. So this one, like seeing him early on in the pubs and stuff and like how public he should be about like getting phone calls and like, you know, who's telling him sort of riddles and who's actually telling him something meaningful, is sort of an interesting setup.
Yeah, I would agree. And he has some, he has some good Bogart moments, most especially when he first goes to the Newcastle racetrack and runs into Ian Hendry's Eric, who is a driver and muscle for this local gangster, Kinnear, played by John Osborne. And he really like Bogarts this guy pretty good, where Eric's just like, why do you want to know all this stuff? And Caine just goes, I'm probably because I'm nosing, which is a great way to say I'm snooping around. And then also he describes him to his face. He says, I barely recognize you without your sunglasses, but there's your eyes, two piss holes in the snow, which is just a great kind of hard boiled noir. Like, you know, the detective's also the writer.
I think this movie's mystery is pretty hard to follow. Is that fair?
Well, you warned me that it would be. So I tried to pay like really close attention. I think I got
it. And even you were like, oh, it's fine, I get it. And then like at the end you were like, yeah, I don't get it.
I think I have the details. I don't know if like the conspiracy like pays off in an interesting way. Do you want me to tell you what happens, or do you want to ask questions about what happens?
Well, Michael Caine plays Jack Carter. Am I there yet?
That's all you need to know.
Am I getting warmer?
You're getting Carter, yes. Go ahead. What are your real questions?
I think that it has something to do with a pornographic videotape by that his niece is in.
Right. Uh-huh. Confirmed.
But then there's the sex worker like in bed with him, and she has a copy of it. And then like she's in the tub and he's very upset. And then he just, I mean, then it becomes Death Wish and he just like kills everyone in sight.
Pretty much.
But I guess why was the brother killed for the porn tape? That was pretty artful, I would have to say. Both in the Italian Job and in this one, it's like the production value of these movies that like were made with such haste, like seem pretty high.
Well, this is a pre-Philip Baker Hall and Boogie Nights ruining everything with tape. These are films, sir.
You're so right.
This breaks down, my friend, to a rivalry between gangsters that essentially everyone is caught in the middle of, right? So it's Brumby? Is that his name? Cliff Brumby, who is a kind of a shady business magnate who's like trying to buy up property, and Kinnear is the local crime lord. So Brumby,
Greg Kinnear, I didn't see him in this.
It's hard to spot him under all of that like sallow makeup. By the way, not to besmirch the English, but everyone in this movie needs to go for a walk and eat a vegetable, like, and drink a glass of water. Everyone is just yellow.
Yeah. Everyone's very jaundiced in this. Yeah. Big bags under their eyes.
Come on,
they need some
people.
Sleep.
Come on.
Maybe it begins with mental health.
Maybe. Or not breathing coal.
It could be an environmental issue as well.
Brumby's trying to bring down Kinnear, and Kinnear is the one making pornographic tapes in... I keep saying tapes. Films involving... Doreen, who's Frank Carter's daughter. So Brumby shows the tape to Frank Carter to try to get him to call the police or to bump off Kinnear himself. Frank Carter does this, but Kinnear doesn't take kindly to it, so they end up killing Frank Carter, and then they try to make it look like an accident. And then this is the same relationship that points out once Michael Caine's Jack Carter plays out once Michael Caine's Jack Carter gets to town. Where it's just these two people are constantly trying to get...
Oh, so it was his own boss that set it up, and that's why the boss comes back at the end.
No, his boss is Fletcher in London, who sends some goons, but is not intimately involved.
Then why are they trying to kill him on that boat at the end? And who's the guy with the blonde hair?
Those were goons sent to bring him back. I mean, they must have business interests or just don't want him like to die in Newcastle.
I thought that they was like I think that the Fletcher is involved in some way because I think the rivalry is between Fletcher and Greg Kinnear.
No, that's wrong. It's explicitly between Brumby and Kinnear, dude.
Is Brumby the guy that gets thrown off the parking lot?
Yes. The only part of this plot that impacts character, which is another demerit we probably need to get to, is where Frank's former friend, who's like a local bartender who's trying to help Jack out, ends up getting beaten up by these goons who are looking for Jack and like yells from this bed like, "We all know how much you suck, Jack, and we know that Doreen is probably your daughter." Which is...
Damn, yeah.
Not the most... nuanced way, or not a good way to actually like sink that into Jack's character, to have someone just like scream it at him and have no... One of the weird things is like you could do some even more basic character work just by having Carter like brood a little bit.
I, like you, was hungry for, I mean, at some point it just becomes this very cold, distant man, you know, without maybe some of the charm of the previous films, killing semi-anonymous, you know, middle-aged white guys in fantastically photographed, seascape hell here.
It kind of, it's like British Peckinpah.
Except, yes, that's a fair comp.
Except that, you know, like I watched Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia this year, which is like a completely like wicked nihilist, you know, sad bastard just like bouncing around fucking and killing and watching the people he cares about be killed. This may not make sense, but in Peckinpah, though, there is a depth to the emptiness. There is a thematic depth to the very point that you'll never be able to connect with this guy because to be alive is a violent torture. And this movie doesn't allow for even that kind of like thematic depth, if that makes sense.
But again, like Michael Caine's doing worse than maybe has been done to him scene to scene. And I think that speaks more to, I mean, the film's interest in establishing him as this sort of alpha, you know, force to be reckoned with. If you're in this kind of, if you're in the game, like you either scare the hell out of people, you know, or get them out of the way.
I think the final murder where he tracks down Eric and forces whiskey down his throat and then dumps him into the sea is actually, I connected with that more, which is a bizarre thing to say because it's just like pure sadism from like a doomed individual. But I think that even what I longed for in this movie was that anything be revealed about anyone. And so when it was revealed that Jack was a sadist, I was like, oh, well, here's a character detail that I can actually invest in. That he's doomed, and this is like the one thing he wants to accomplish in your classic kind of revenge reconciliation sort of way. Right. But what is revealed about anyone else in this movie at any point? That's an interesting detail.
Yeah, it's one of these movies that, after watching it, I said, huh.
Yeah.
You know, kind of with a question mark, but kind of with an exclamation point. You know, I thought it was beautiful and gorgeous to watch. Like, even the, I don't know, even the photography of people's faces, like, just seemed more, had to have more clarity than the previous two movies. And maybe that's just the cut I saw.
What about that, like, the Sunday morning Undertaker vibes of all the cops coming to the house at the end? Like, that, those were wonderfully and moodily directed.
For sure. Yeah, and there's a lot of good technical stuff here that I think makes this movie seminal in the move away from classic Hollywood noir to the long goodbyes of it all.
Yeah.
And then like what we're kind of doing, you know, now with the noir thrillers that come out mostly from independent cinema. But in terms of entertainment value, it has such a bleak, obscure worldview that it's hard to like, I don't know, be that moved emotionally by this.
Yeah, I agree with this. And I think it could go bleaker. I think if you felt the hand of fate a little more on the scale, that would help.
Yes.
But yeah, I just feel like a guy who's just like still falling into bed with people and he's not going to kill that person yet, but soon he will.
Go ahead. That's the thing you were talking about up front is the idea that what makes these sort of cool early Michael Caine roles is being smart enough to like get into trouble.
Yeah.
And I guess I wanted a little bit more of him having like the foresight to like do whatever in order to outsmart these hometown goons. But really it's just like this guy's just more vicious than them. So he's obviously going to win. And I don't know, I mean, this gets into my critique of just like this kind of Michael Caine, but I also don't know that I believe Michael Caine to be a physically imposing force.
Right. I'm going to give this movie a good bad. I think that the directing in a lot of scenes does carry the day. it's a movie that was like reclaimed and shouted out in the 90s by people like Quentin Tarantino and Guy Ritchie, and you can totally feel like both of them would love a movie like this, because in their version of it, they would like fill it with detail, like Quentin with like really interesting detail and Guy Ritchie with really stupid detail. But like they would take the anonymous goons and they would be like, oh, that's one-eye Robbins, like never talk to him about parrots, is like the Guy Ritchie version of this movie, instead of it just being like a guy with a comb over who falls off a cliff. So, but yeah, it's hard to connect with. But you know, some people are just into like, you know, vicious genre.
Some people don't like to connect with the thing that they're watching.
No, some people like vicious genre fare from the 70s, and if that's you, go nuts. I'm going to give it a good bad.
Interesting. I wonder who thinks of themselves as a fan of vicious genre films from the 1970s. People, anyone we know?
Some film geeks I know who are just like pride themselves on being like, that exploitation movies were the height of cinema.
I think this one is, yes, I think it's a good bad. I think on a technical level, there's some really good photography here. Clearly it inspires like a whole world of, you know, yes, like the Quentin Tarantinos and like, you know, without this movie, I would not have had to sit through The Gentlemen a couple days back. So yeah, I'll give it a good bad, but it is not like a fun or pleasant watch. And if you're looking for just like a sort of not easy to follow, but like a, you know, normal ability to follow, this one is not for you.
Noah found this movie abnormal. What is this?
I found this one abnormally hard to follow.
That's funny. So the next year, we're going to make a really brief pit stop with Sleuth in 1972, directed by Joe Mankiewicz, brother of Herman, who 100% wrote every word of Citizen Kane.
That old drunk.
Joe Mankiewicz, the great director of All About Eve and other films. This is a two-hander of Olivier and Kane, where Olivier is this wildly theatrical, conniving, successful mystery writer who invites his wife's lover to the house to try to involve him in this like weird plot to essentially get those two away from him and with a little money and out of his life forever. And it really like lands somewhere between like Knives Out and Clue. A really, really meta movie for 1972.
For sure.
And Olivier is unbelievable in it. And Kane really has the good sense, kind of like he does with Connery in the movie that we're about to talk about, where it's like, yeah, I'm going to let this... I wish I had better terms, but basically it's like, I'm going to let the alpha be the alpha here, and I'm just going to react. And he is fantastic. And I don't want to spoil it, but he ends up playing multiple roles in the movie. In the first half, where he plays Milo, you get some really interesting commentary on a character who's actually using Michael Caine's Cockney voice and like his working class background is a really interesting and abrasive kind of oil and water with Andrew Wyke, the Olivier character. So it's interesting to see a movie draw explicit attention to the idea that he doesn't have the same breeding as some of the acting peers that the people would consider him in the same pantheon as. Have you seen Sleuth?
I have. I've seen the original and I've seen the remake, which Michael Caine moves over to the Olivier role, right? And then 2000 and whatever's Michael Caine, Jude Law, steps in to play that role.
You said the remake's terrible.
The remake's definitely not as good as the original. And just a private note to myself here, I thought it was amazing that you managed to talk about the basic setup of this movie without saying the word cuckold.
I leave 100% of those references to you.
I'm glad that I brought it up though, then, because if that was my role, then I fulfilled it.
There you go. Yeah. So bummer that this movie is not streaming, but if you can find it, I would certainly recommend it. Both Olivia and Kane were Oscar nominated for their performances. It is like really fun and but menacing at the same time. Like it really feels like late Joe Mank. The idea that like Joe Mankiewicz came from, you know, this kind of like hyper written, like really good but churning machine of Hollywood movies in the 40s and 50s, and then at kind of this late stage is gonna like make a movie version of this Tony Award winning play that is kind of commenting on and playing with like the mystery mode that so many of the golden age of Hollywood movies were about, with like this aging theater star and Kane still kind of in Lothario mode. It is a great, great mismatch of things. Highly recommend.
For sure. And it's also, it's going to kick off, I feel like, this thing that really picked up in the late 70s all the way to, I don't know, M. Night Shyamalan or something, with this idea of like, nope, that's not the ending. It's something else. Nope, actually, it's something else. You know, and that, yeah, that sort of like last act, sort of like single or even double, it's not what you think.
Okay, so 1975 is the end of the road for young Kane, and I think like a really interesting way, because I love how both Connery and Kane in this movie, I don't know what their actual ages were, late 30s, early 40s, but they're so like perfectly 37. Like they're undertaking this project with like the last glimmer of like vigor that they have in them, and they both actually kind of like wear their youth in a sort of disturbing way, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I would say it's like the last gasps of that youthful charisma that Kane has in these previous movies, and then of course that like Connery has through the 60s.
Right.
And this one, like the grays are coming out like in the temples and on the side of the beard, and like Connery is no longer wearing his hairpiece. And yeah, and with Kane too, he's still in that, he's almost like the last shot of Alfie at this point, where, you know, he's out of his prime of being in the military and they're like looking for their next hustle. And, you know, parenthetically, before we make Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, why don't we try to like take over a fucking country with our Western values?
Well, he's still like 13 years away from Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, but
you know, it's a long climb.
It's true.
To get there.
There is no place on earth too forbidding. There is no adventure too dangerous to dare. There is no dream of wealth and glory too impossible for the man who would be king. Connery and Kane. Rogue and renegade. Reckless and fearless soldiers of fortune on the richest adventure of their life. Across 1,000 miles of danger, come with Sean Connery and Michael Caine as they try to capture a whole country, a scheme for rascals to become royalty in the long-lost land of Alexander the Great. Rudyard Kipling's The Man Who Would Be King.
And I think what adds to that, too, in kind of a brilliant, or maybe goofy, you'll have to tell me, way, is the way that this movie is framed. And so our lead into this movie, the person like through whom we're understanding this tall tale here, is the famous author Rudyard Kipling, here played by Christopher Plummer, R.I.P. Christopher Plummer. Mm-hmm. And frankly, at the beginning of, at this point in his career, looking a lot like Michael Fassbender.
Sure.
But yeah, so we see this like sort of like broken old pirate kind of like wanders into the Northern Star, this like English language newspaper in India. And it turns out that like it's It's the guy that he met 3 years earlier and went was about to go on this wild expedition. And so we kind of look off into the horizon and we cut back to 3 years ago when Rudyard Kipling and Peachy, the Michael Caine character, have this run-in at this train station, and Kipling gets involved because he's a fucking Freemason. He somehow has like affection for these guys and gets involved in their gambit to go to this yet sort of uncharted part of Afghanistan and Pakistan to take over as the sort of last frontier here and bring what they've learned in the army to gain power and wealth, you know, sort of in the new world, so to speak. And so that's what they do.
I think it's a really interesting fable about two soldiers who only understand step one of empire building.
I think they understand maybe steps 1 through 9 of like a 12-step process. Like, I think they're pretty good at like having the zeal to physically make the trip to get there. Like, and they have just enough dumb luck on their side that their laughter causes an avalanche that like reveals a passageway that didn't previously exist. And I think they're charming enough. And like, yes, it's good luck on their side, really, like with the incident with the arrow that kind of sets up the whole thing. It's just dumb luck that Connery isn't taken out in the first battle.
That's what I mean, though. They're only good at like a war and deposing people.
Now I take it back, and you're quite right, because they're like, let's just line up here with this army and hope for the best, and then Connery's like charging in while they're still firing the arrows.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, you're quite right that they just have kind of the cojones to do the thing without sort of thinking through, like, what is the thing again?
Well, because they're in colonized India and they're both just complaining and complaining about the bureaucracy of the crown. This idea of like what it is to rule in the Victorian era. They want no part of it.
Right.
They just want to be Victoria.
Yes, and they're exactly. They want to be at the top, and they see their passageway to what they consider to be success, you know, blocked by the government there. They're sort of like proto-libertarians,
yes,
where they like
right.
believe in the free market of whatever. But you know, the thing is, the what they have to offer is just like flim flam.
Uh-huh.
You know, a lot of they have showmanship. And that's like the thing that they keep going back to, like, don't forget showmanship.
When Connery and Caine like march into the office of the Northern Star newspaper editor and are like, yeah, our plan was to blackmail this Raja and you were going to print it because we know this stuff about your sister. And Michael Caine is like, hats on, hats off. And they're like both doing it in perfect synchronicity. It's like some real like comedy duo shit. And I think that there is this part of the movie where like these two are such like bros from another era, where in some ways it's especially where Christopher Plummer's character is confirmed. It's like, listen, when you come across two people who are this connected in history and vernacular, do not try to be the third wheel between them, because you are not ready for like the Virginia Woolf's, like the Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf's amount of dynamics between these two people that cannot right. be reshaped or reformed.
That's very interesting. Yeah. I almost think that there is, and maybe this is not the hottest take in the world, but I almost think there's like a queer read on this story too, that a movie that's so concerned with masculinity that it almost like goes too far. And then it just sort of posits these two men as perhaps like, maybe they're like romantically involved, which is, I think, is an interesting way to frame it as well.
Yeah. I don't know if I like necessarily see that between them, but there is something really interesting about they make this compact as they venture into Kafiristan, which is that they won't drink and they won't sleep with anybody. And
sleep with women, just to be clear.
Right, right, right. right. There you go. And I think that that on one hand, like, that just like creates a couple moments of comedy. But on the other, I think it's actually brilliant character work, because again, they are, you know, approaching 40 and they are conquerors who in their minds are forever 25, and they kind of know that each other are fuck ups and they are like men of appetite. And it's just this, like, you know, adolescent like blood oath between them that's gonna keep them from screwing this up. And of course they can't. Like, it's so funny that they have this very faint flickering understanding of how dangerous they both are, and they're doomed in that way,
right? But they kind of know that in the end they'll have the other one.
Yes.
Which is frankly a reason that you have a spouse,
right? There you go.
But yeah, no, I agree with what you're saying. You know, and I think too, part of the comedy, at least in like the like last reel of this, is the fact that there's that similar tension of, oh, like, who makes more money in this relationship? Like, oh, you know, you may be like the, you know, treated so royally and like live in this palace, but like I'm the god, right, here. You know, and there's something, you know, again, talking about how these movies deal with, you know, power between men and women and like what the idea of being alpha and what the idea of being a predator is and where the line is there. This movie, like, you know, sort of comes off in its first, you know, hour, and this is a long movie, first hour and change being kind of this Disney-ified, like, you know, heroes on a quest and like on an adventure and like, you know, we're going to make it or we're going to not make it, but it's, we're going to do it by our own, pulling up our own bootstraps. But then they like sort of, this movie has a more heart of darkness to it, I think, when Connery decides that he has to marry, parenthetically, Michael Caine's wife. And the movie becomes a sort of searing indictment more of like male power and control that I think is super timely, and kind of gives this movie maybe like a pass for its otherwise problematic geopolitics.
We should say, of course, that like John Huston adapting, I mean, John Huston's made some incredible movies, Treasure of the Sierra Madre, African Queen, but both of those movies I just mentioned are not passing cultural sensitivity tests, and especially not when we're adapting Rudyard Kipling, you know?
Right. Well, between Huston and Kipling, like, we're not exactly talking about the most like sensitive of gentlemen in this period.
No, we're talking about people who made African Queen and wrote White Man's Burden. I actually think the worst, it's a good performance from Saeed Jaffrey as Billy Fish, who is this an Indian soldier who had served with the British, who they come across in Kafiristan, who kind of becomes their translator and their envoy to talk to the people whom they'd like to make subjects. It's a good performance, but like, I think the movie does Billy Fish pretty dirty. He's one of the few supporting characters who the film invests in at all. And he's kind of portrayed as like extremely naive, to the point of him like dying for the people who, like, he was just sitting around like waiting for white people to show up, and he's like, oh great, now I can serve you and die for you. That's insulting. I think that's worse than any of the, like, right, the street market snake charming stuff.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with you, and I would tweak it a bit further to say that he definitely portrays like sort of this model minority slash like house servant role that seems to be a character that's pretty prevalent in Western literature, from The Tempest to, you know, The Help.
Sure. Yeah, exactly. Well, and you can, but, you just see there's so much opportunity with that character too, because you basically have two guys who are on an adventure toward their own demise, and to have like a third voice with them who has a different view of what's going on, and whether he's just like warning them or whether he wants some of the fortune for himself, or let him, there's so much opportunity for him to have a more complex relationship with colonizing Brits. Like, it's sitting right there, and it's dumb that the movie doesn't do anything with it. I'm going to say again, you know, 46-year-old movie. If you don't want to hear us talk about the end because you want to go watch this, it's on HBO Max. I might drop out because the end is pretty unbelievable, but we got to unpack it.
Yeah, because I think we're giving this movie a tough time in its, you know, because I think we're all having this conversation now, like, what do you do with movies that have less than politically sensitive subjects in there and dealing with things that we thought were good ideas and turned out not to be in the popular imagination. But this one is, frankly, like, a lot of fun. Like, the collaboration between Connery and Kane really does bring a level of, like, you know, how far are these con men going to go, you know, before the House of Cards topples over? And, like, how, like, watchable that conceit is, I don't think can be overstated.
But I think, to your point, yeah, it is interesting to try to figure out what to do with it. And for me to say that, like, the exoticism is just window dressing is... That's me shrugging that off as a white person. But I think what's good about it is, like, it's a movie under which the terrain is colonialism. It's not pretending that, like, this didn't happen or it was great or it was innocent. Even something like Zulu, I've heard Michael Caine say, like, oh, I just thought it was like a, we just looked on it as like an innocent war movie. It's like, you did? Because that's stupid and ignorant. Like, this is a movie that understands that these are guys who are fed up with the colonialism that's already happened. Let's do more. And that all of colonialism in its own way is a house of cards. So yeah, you get to the end of it and Connery's, of course, gambit to be a god goes horribly wrong. In I think, like, a pretty... Like, it's a little bit funny that he's just like, King? Nah, I'll be God. What do you mean I can't marry people? I'm God. I'll do what I want. I'll Zeus this shit. Doesn't work out.
No. Yeah. Shakira Kane bites him, and because he bleeds, they realize this is no God. He's the man who would be king.
Right. When Peachy plops the head and the crown on Rudyard Kipling's desk at the end.
I love that part.
Do you think the movie has been narrated on the level and literally the entire time? Or do you think there was a point where Peachy started painting over stuff?
Oh, I think the presumption is that it's a tall tale.
Yeah.
And that some things may not have happened the way they're explained. And that may speak to the luckiness that these guys have. And I get the sense too that, like, some of this guy's, like, blackened skin and scar tissue covering him, like, maybe came from the journey leading up to them being kicked out.
Like, you think they might have dropped out as early as the avalanche, and that's some frostbite, maybe?
That's true, too. I just mean that it wasn't as seamless as this guy explains it to be, and that this, like, his literally being crucified by these people was maybe, like, just sort of the punctuation of, you know, this guy living hard, this lifestyle that's unsustainable, this very Michael Caine character of having a moral code that doesn't make a ton of sense to you or I, but this guy is going to go for it full bore because that's what he believes will yield fortune.
I think there's some really cool directorial moments from John Huston that can kind of inform your read on at what point was Sean Connery's Daniel Dravot beheaded. when they first see the riches, like the treasure trove of Kafiristan, I really love Huston puts no music in that scene. It's a really kind of eerie, sight and sensorial experience where they're looking around at just like mountains of gold, the Cave of Forgotten Wonders. And there's no like, there's no understanding that the audience should be like, yeah, they made it. Cool. They're rich. And they're just kind of like mumbling and whispering to themselves, like, we could be millionaires. We could be millionaires. And I love how eerie that is. And then in the final death of Daniel, the Connery character, which is a great death, he like marches out onto the rope bridge as they're cutting it down, and they start to sing this English soldiers fight song, and the soundtrack's like playing the horn with them. It's like, da-da-da-da-da. And I kind of found myself in that moment being like, this movie has not musically been supporting the belief system of these two characters previously. What's going on here? And I think it's like the Scorsese Shutter Island thing where like the score is really ramped up in the perception of this unreliable narrator. Like, I don't think that the death was not so glorious as it was portrayed, clearly.
No. And I love the visual motif too of like, once you see them playing soccer with like two different guys' heads, you like know that that third head is coming, you know, whether it's Michael. Oh, it's got to be Sean.
Right.
So, I totally agree with you that I think this movie has like a dark sense of humor to it. And for that, like as dated and questionable as this movie is, I think, especially in the context of the four of them here, it's a good.
I would totally agree.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed it. Like, if you can, this is the kind of thing where, like, Alfie, tough to get over. Like, he's Alfie the whole fucking time. This one, I feel like once it becomes sort of this story of, like, stranger in a strange land mixed with the con artist kind of proto Dirty Rotten Scoundrels conceit, like, it's just very fun.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's unnecessarily cruel to, other than Billy Fish, I don't think it's that cruel to any of the supporting characters in that exploitative a way.
It mostly just ignores them.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, unfortunate. But again, I think I'm using the word fable very intentionally. There are not that many 6th, 7th, 8th characters in fables. It's about Daniel and Peachy and this narrator construct of Rudyard Kipling. Yeah, I think Houston does a very deft job, and so do both actors, of this balance between, like, we're movie stars, and we're total madmen. And you always, you get to enjoy a little bit of the, like, we're marching, and then being like, but you guys are nutcases. You're people, right, who should have been kicked out of the army 10 years ago, and now you want to go start a new war because it's the only thing you know how to do.
Exactly. Yeah.
And that, yeah.
And I think too, like, even on a smaller level, just like seeing these characters grow and change, you know, they're kind of on the same level, but then the second that Connery gets sort of, you know, elevated to this level of God,
yeah,
you know, there's the, he's like, you know, 1,000 feet tall for a few scenes, but then it's like, he's like sort of sinks into madness, you know, then Kane is kind of like walking in front of him and like looming over him and like has sort of taken the high ground, so to speak. And so much so that Connery's like, please don't walk in front of me. Like, you have to kneel.
Right.
And Kane's like, okay. Okay. And then he just continues to do what he was doing, kind of sulking back and forth just out of his eye line. And I think that's, you know, seeing the Kane thing kind of go from, you know, con man with, you know, all the charm in the world and none of the shame, go to like, okay, man, like, let's get out of here.
Yeah.
Like, the world does have its limitations and we're at the end of our cautionary tale here, is a really interesting thing to consider that I think will elevate Kane into like all time status when we get into this next like 20 year period here.
Yeah, it's really significant and far more believable that Connery is the one who charges into the middle of, you know, 50 people with spears, like, and Kane is like, what are you doing? That in being the beta of the pair, like, he's the survivor. He's the one who is gonna, like, make it out of this.
Right.
Because he's the one who can do
and
the math.
And in many ways,
it's a great motif where Connery is trying to like divvy out cattle, and he can't carry the one.
He can't do the math. Yeah. No, but I think that that is sort of an overarching takeaway, too, of what Michael Caine's career will be. It's just like the best Beta there ever was.
Sure.
You know, the best supporting guy that you feel like he's a leading man. But I don't know that, like, without another person's sort of ruin or whatever, like his Batman to play off of, his Bruce Wayne, like he, I don't know, like doesn't have the same resonance. And then it, you know, in these previous three felt a little small.
Mm-hmm. He also,
and creepy.
To his credit, he is enlivened by being around other actors who he and the movie believe to be of his caliber. He's having so much fun with Sean Connery and Laurence Olivier in these last two movies that we've talked about. And whether through him or just the movie's treatment of them, like, there's just not one single character in Alfie, Italian Job, or Get Carter who is on the level of his characters. Like, he doesn't do battle with anyone in three movies that are allegedly classic that we watched, which is so odd.
Yes. So maybe it's really
Shelley
like,
Winters.
The two-hander.
Sorry.
Sure. But I think the two-hander is like a better look for Caine.
Yeah. I would agree.
You know, and that's cool.
Lots of many people do better in a tango. Me with you. You with
what?
Casey.
Are we each other's Michael Caines?
Sure. I haven't heard your Michael Caine impression, but I imagine it's something like, I'm Michael Caine.
I love that you have an impression of Steve Coogan doing a bad impression of Michael Caine.
I've told you before. All right. This was fun, and I look forward to seeing you for
middle Michael Caine and end Michael Caine.
Exactly, middle Michael Caine when we do Educating Rita and Dirty Rotten Scoundrels and try to talk our way around Hannah and her sisters. Should be fun, I said about this podcast we're never going to do.
Yes, let's not do that.
All right. Oh, yeah, 1 week from now, we're talking about Amnesia movies. So on the off chance that you've made it this far into Be Real, watch Memento and Long Kiss Goodnight and Mulholland Drive.
And Memoirs of an Invisible Man.
No. I have no fucking idea where that's coming from. Bye, dude.
Bye.
I've not heard your Michael Caine, but I assume it would be something along the lines of, my name's Michael Caine.
That is where you are so wrong. And you can look at my live video for proof, because that's the very thing I don't do. I say that he used to talk like that.
Do you, Michael Caine?
Okay. I say, Michael Caine used to talk like this in the 1960s, right? But that has changed. And I say that over the years, Michael's voice has come down several octaves. Let me finish. And all of the cigars and the brandy, don't let me finish, can now be heard.
Okay.
I've not fucking finished. In the back of the voice, and the voice okay. Now. Well, I've still not finished the voice.
You're panicking.
I've, yeah, no, because you look like you're about to bloody talk. Let me finish. Right, so, Michael Caine's voice now, in the Batman movies and in Harry Brown. I can't go fast because Michael Caine talks very, very slowly.